Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On January 1st, Ohio's minimum wage increased by a dime to $7.95 per hour. Ohio is among a handful of states that have set their minimum wage level higher than the federal minimum, but many still are critical because they question whether minimum wage is actually a living wage, and still others question the idea of a minimum wage altogether. Joining us now to talk about what we mean by a living and minimum wage is Amy Glassmeyer. She is Department Head of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where she teaches both economic geography and regional planning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So could we define the terms? A lot of people use them interchangeably, minimum wage, living wage. Are they interchangeable?
No, they're not. They have different origins. They date to different times, and they serve different purposes. The minimum wage was created in the 1930s in response to both a period of financial crisis as well as a recognition that there were certain types of labor practices that the federal government felt were unproductive and also problematic because they included such things as child labor. And it was also recognized at the time, again, it was a question of a period of economic decline and troubles in the national economy overall. There was a belief that the ability to have wages flexibly set everywhere at all times meant places were bidding against one another, and it was also the case that people were working below the value that they were producing, which had long-term consequences for consumption. So you wanted the public to be able to buy the goods that you were producing, but you weren't paying them a wage for them to be able to do it. That's very different from the living wage. Living wage as a concept actually dates back to the beginning of the 20th century, when you can find literature that talks about the fact that people needed to be paid a wage upon which they could live. It kind of goes dormant as an idea for much of the 20th century, but it pops back up again starting in the 70s and early 80s after the nation went through a serious recession, partly associated with the oil crisis, but also a host of other factors. And we were seeing that there was a growing gap between the cost of living and the actual base wage people were being paid. And since the base wage starts at the minimum wage, it began to become obvious the minimum wage was not paying a wage that allowed people to basically pay for basic goods. And so the living wage as a concept is trying to suggest that there is a certain amount of money that's required to buy the basics: housing, food, clothing, shelter, medical care, transportation, the things that we need to operate as citizens in society.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Amy Glassmeyer. She is the Department Head of Urban Studies and Planning at MIT. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking about the living wage and minimum wage and where the two meet or not in our society. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Was the minimum wage, as it was calculated back in the 30s when it was created, was it seen as something that was going to support a family?
Technically speaking, I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. Since it's applied to individuals, my presumption is that it was considering the experience of an individual and how they managed their lives, but not that it was viewed as a family wage. And there really isn't anything in the history that I can see that talks about the minimum wage linking to a family per se.
And I want to talk about the online tool you developed called the Living Wage Calculator. But first, I wanted to ask you whether over time the concept of living wage has changed. In other words, the components that make up a lifestyle of a life and the cost of paying for that, have those components, the weights of them, changed over time, or have they been pretty static?
Well, so there's they have changed. So there is evidence to show you that back in the beginning of the 20th century, people spent about 40% of their income on food. Today they pay something closer to 7%. So we know, factually speaking, that components of existence have changed. In terms of the minimum wage or the living wage calculator, those are measures that we build based on a point in time and what's reflected at that time. So some people critique not so much the minimum wage but the poverty rate as reflecting a basket of goods that were constructed in the 1960s rather than what people need to live today. My living wage calculator and most of the living wage calculators that other people have attempt to deal with reality as we understand it today.
So how does the calculator work?
Well, basically what we did was take a basket of goods that are necessary to operate in the world today, and we collected information on that basket of goods for the country. We went by county, and then we aggregate counties into cities. And then we sum how much it actually costs. So what's the fair market rent as determined by HUD? What is the National Association of Insurance Salespeople say is the, you know, average price of health insurance? What is the locally determined value for the amount of money people spend on food? So we tried to localize all of our measures, and then we simply sum them, and we say, okay, for one person, it takes this much money. For one person and a child, it takes this much money. And then we vary the family size, and we make some judgments about, given a family size, who's going to be working and how much money they need in order to have a living wage.
To what extent does a living wage look forward? In other words, does it include the money that people need to invest in their future for education and so forth?
No. And let me say two things. One is, my calculator was developed to answer the following question. What is the actual minimum living wage a person needs in a place? I was actually looking at a living wage relative to either the minimum wage or poverty income, because I wanted to know whether or not either a wage or the poverty income level actually were sufficient so somebody could survive. And what I discovered in calculating the living wage using my tool was that neither the poverty level income nor the minimum wage made it possible for somebody to make it. That's for this time, not looking into the future and saying, I need to go to college, I need to go to a technical school, I need to add to my human capital. That doesn't say things about I need to fix my house. That doesn't say I need to go and have my teeth fixed. It's just simply, what do I need to exist?
Over time, what's been the biggest change? You mentioned food. Of course, that's a huge change. Back in the early 20th century, you said it took up 40% of our budget, 7% today. Are there any other big changes?
Well, so we now live in a society where both, if you have a partnership, husband and wife family, it is the case that husbands and wives typically work. That means they have to pay for child care. Hmm. Child care is a very, very large expense. Hmm. Health care. So until now, we didn't have a program with providing people access to reasonably priced health care. It depended on whether you had an you worked for an employer who actually provided you with health care and you contributed to it. Now that we have a national system, the cost of health care is likely to go down. But up until this point, health care was also a very big cost. Health care was not assumed 50 years ago. It is now the case that we recognize as a nation, unhealthy people are unproductive. Unproductive assets are a drag on the national economy.
What about technology? You often hear sniping, for lack of a better word, about people who say, well, they can't afford to do this, but they can sure afford to have a TV set and a VCR or a DVD or a Blu-ray or whatever it might be, and not to mention having a computer in a household. Is that something that we should be considering as fundamental now going forward?
For other industrialized nations, there is a use of a median. 60% of the median is considered poverty rate in most other industrialized countries. Ours is an absolute value that was set and is set by the federal government. The belief that there is some minimum amount of materialists that people need to have a decent standard of living is something we decide as a society. Some people argue that poor people shouldn't have washing machines. Some people argue poor people shouldn't have cars. But the bottom line is you need a washing machine and you need a car. You need a car to get to work. You need a washing machine to wash your clothes so you're clean when you go to work. In terms of things like televisions, I think we make a choice as a society that there's certain elements of the material world, like televisions, that we think are really pretty much a part of the standard. That's what we see as a standard basket of goods that we think people need to have. Now, whether they need a Blu-ray or they need the fanciest and the newest, that's a totally separate issue. Mm-hmm. But I think from the standpoint of asking, what does it take to feel like you're a member of society, to feel that you have value as a member of society, there are certain things that I think people expect to be able to have access to.
As far as a living wage goes in your calculations of it, how much variation do we see across the country? Does the basic living wage, what it takes to live, does it vary a lot?
It varies a lot. So it varies most between urban and non-urban areas. Then it varies by region in terms of the dynamic nature of the economy, because there are higher cost regions and there are higher wages in those regions, and then there are lower cost regions. It also varies by the history of regions and the tendency to have been dominated by lower wage industries versus higher wage industries. So we have differences in the living wage in the South than the North, and that's simply because of the industrial base. So it does vary a lot, but it varies. The biggest variation that you see is urban to rural. But let me say that you'd be surprised that in rural areas you have significant problems in components of the living wage, and that would be in things like housing. So in rural places, there isn't an abundance of housing, and there's definitely not an abundance of rental housing. So people pay, you know, on a comparative basis, higher for rental housing in rural areas, given the overall cost of living there, because there's a shortage of supply.
My experience of reporting in rural areas in Ohio is that most people in the rural areas don't work there. They work outside of the rural area, and that transportation is a really big problem for them because there's no mass transit.
That is. That really is a huge issue. And there are parts of the country where people commute 50 miles one way to work and back. That's the same kind of trip that a kid can actually make in a school bus.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no doubt that, you know, in rural, people think of rural having only a cost advantage because everything seems to be less costly there. But everything has to be trucked in, and there's a very big commute cost that's incurred by living in rural places.
Well, Amy Glassmeyer, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Amy Glassmeyer is the Department Head of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It's where she teaches both economic geography and regional planning. Coming up, we'll talk about the living wage, minimum wage. Where do the two ever meet, if ever? After this, this is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On January 1st, Ohio's minimum wage increased by a dime to $7.95 per hour. In fact, Ohio is among a handful of states that have set their minimum wage level higher than the federal minimum. Joining us to talk about the purpose and the pros and cons of the minimum wage in the United States and Ohio is Amy Hanauer. She's executive director of the Cleveland-based think tank Policy Matters Ohio. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks so much.
Also joining us is Greg Lawson. He's a lobbyist and an analyst for the Buckeye Institute. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you very much.
All righty. So, Amy, the Ohio minimum wage went up 10 cents to $7.95. Doesn't seem like much to somebody who isn't working at the minimum wage level, but I'm wondering, what does that bump mean overall for Ohio?
Yeah, I mean, it's great for Ohio that we have a minimum wage that's modestly higher than the federal level and that is indexed to inflation. Although I think the thing that we and every other state really needs is for the federal minimum wage to go up to $10.10 an hour, which is a current proposal in front of the federal government. But, you know, the raise that we got in Ohio means that we will create jobs here. It means that we will reduce poverty here. It means that we will reduce inequality here. And it means that working people will be doing just a little bit better. So it's not a lot. It's not enough. But it certainly is better than nothing for the people getting it.
Now, Greg Lawson, I would imagine you would say, no, it doesn't create jobs. It costs jobs.
That would be an accurate statement. And I think that if you look at since we've had the minimum wage, we haven't seen a vast amount of jobs being created in the state of Ohio. As a matter of fact, the entire decade between 2000 and 2010, we lost well over 600,000 private sector jobs in the state of Ohio, and the lion's share of that came after the minimum wage increase. Now, that's obviously, there's the Great Recession that occurred in that time period, so I'm not saying that the minimum wage is the core cause of that, but if the minimum wage hike was going to be overly beneficial, we would have seen, I think, somewhat of a stemming of what was essentially an economic bloodletting in Ohio. So, yes, I think that, and if you look at academic literature from many, many years, not just, I know there's some new academic literature that raises some questions and tries to push back on this, but for years, decades, the overwhelming consensus was that increases in the minimum wage definitely did have a negative impact on the number of jobs that are created. That's one of the reasons why increasing the minimum wage is always seen by organizations like the Buckeye Institute as being of questionable benefit in the long term. It may help the individuals who have the job, but it doesn't do anything for somebody who isn't getting the job. And we have a real fear that what it actually does is it lifts that ladder of success that we want to get people on. They may start on those lower rungs, but the point is they're going to climb those rungs and move up. We're afraid this pushes that ladder out of reach for even that bottom rung.
You know, I was just talking to Amy Glassmeyer from MIT about that and about this living wage and what it takes. And she said that the poverty level, where we set the poverty level at right now, and also the minimum wage, all things being equal, is not getting us even to a living wage. And I asked her, well, I didn't put it this way, but where's that bootstrap component? Where is that I can invest in my future component when you're making so little money? You're saying it's a start, but when she's saying you can't get here from there.
Well, I think...
Yeah, you know...
I wanted to ask Greg to respond to that real quick, Amy.
Well, I would say for some people, that is definitely going to be a challenge. But we also have to be very careful that we also understand that the minimum wage, many of the individuals that are actually earning the minimum wage aren't the sole breadwinner in a household. A lot of times they're younger individuals. They may be in school, maybe in high school, or they may be moving into college or things like that. So we have to be very careful that we don't always have the assumption that every single person that's subject to the minimum wage is the sole breadwinner or, you know, the single parent with a child. That's usually what's used when we talk about increasing the minimum wages. Those are the faces that are always put towards the policy
argument.
But
those are some of the faces.
Those are some of the faces. But we also have to understand that a good chunk of these individuals aren't there, are other types of individuals. And the problem you run the risk of is if you hike that wage, the law of economics is if you increase the cost of something, people are going to use less of it. And you run a very strong risk of dropping out some of the folks, especially some of the individuals that have less skills early on. And that's the problem of moving that ladder up is they don't get in there. So we talk about the living wage, how do you get from there to there? You're not going to get anywhere if you have zero income.
Amy Hanauer, first of all, can you, you know, talk about who is on minimum wage? What do we know about the breakdown of who earns minimum wage in this country?
Yeah, okay, so Greg is one of my very favorite right-wing people, but it's hard to address.
I always like talking to you guys. Yeah, go ahead.
But it's hard to address the number of wrong statements he made in the last couple of minutes, but I will try.
Okay.
First of all, among affected workers, among the people who will be affected by increasing the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour over the next couple of years, the average age is 35 years old. So many, many of these workers are adults, and in fact, young workers comprise only a small small fraction of those affected. Only about 12% are teens, and of course they deserve to earn a decent living too. And in fact, more of those affected are age 55 or older than are teenagers. So the idea that these are not prime age workers or older workers is just wrong. The other thing that is absolutely true is that this affects families, and those who would be affected come largely from families with low to moderate income levels. There are lots and lots of children whose lifestyles would be raised and who would be brought out of poverty by their parents getting the raise. So of the nation's roughly 75 million children, nearly one-fifth have at least one parent who would receive a raise if the minimum wage were raised to $10.10 an hour. So it is absolutely the case that these are vital jobs in our economy, that these are families. And the truth is that it actually creates jobs if you increase the minimum wage. And
how?
The reason for that is that the lowest income workers in our economy are spending pretty much everything that they're bringing in because, as Amy Glassmeyer pointed out in the first segment of the show, they are not earning enough to meet their basic needs. So if you give those workers a wage, they go out and spend more in the economy. So Greg talked about his fears, he talked about theory, but what he didn't talk about is the most recent economic evidence, which just it's like not even really debated anymore. It is just across the board pretty much understood that this creates jobs, a modest number of jobs, that it reduces inequality, that it reduces poverty, and that it helps the gains in our economy to be more broadly shared. And back when the minimum wage was higher, what it would, you know, would be the equivalent to if we were to raise it to $10.10 an hour, we had an economy that was more broadly shared. We have a very consumer-driven economy. I would actually love to change that, but right now that is the way that we stimulate our economy. And the fact that the policies that Greg and his allies have been promoting have laid off public sector workers and have kept wages low is a large part of the reason that Ohio's economy is not recovering.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what it costs to live and whether or not the minimum wage can or should get us there. With Amy Hanauer, she's executive director of the Cleveland-based think tank Policy Matters Ohio, and Greg Lawson of the Buckeye Institute. If you have a question or comment about the minimum wage, about the living wage, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Greg, what about the idea that the less you have, the more of that more larger percentage you spend? We just talked about how people in those low-income levels, and let's talk about now not the students who are working a part-time job or the mothers who are working a part-time job to, you know, mm-hmm. while the kids are in school or something. Let's talk about the people who are depending on the money. They do spend a larger percentage, if not all of it. So what about it goes right back out into the economy? That's good.
There's for the people who have the jobs and are subject to the minimum wage. Yes, they're going to end up with more money in their pocket. Yes, they're going to spend some more of that money. That's true. But the problem is, I don't think that the consensus is quite as monolithic as Amy mentioned earlier in terms of the fact that it doesn't have, or that it has a modest improvement in terms of the job numbers. And I think that is the real core issue that is of such concern. Is it's beneficial if you get it. It's not beneficial when it reverberates out and you don't get it at all and you don't get the job. And there is an example. This is a stark example, and there's some unique things to the circumstance here, it's going to sound. But American Samoa, it's actually a territory in the United mm-hmm. States. Back in 2007, Congress actually applied the federal minimum wage to American Samoa. The American Samoan delegation, they don't have a congressman, but they have a delegate who does stuff, actually asked them to suspend or freeze the minimum wage because they had actually seen a 19% decline in employment. Now, there's some unique things to their
economy.
It's an
island economy.
It's an island economy. There's definitely some unique things there. So you can't necessarily take that and apply that same starkness of the numbers. But there's a case study of a place that actually did see a minimum wage, and those were a lot of lower skilled. Apparently, they have a fairly large tuna canning, basically, economy. There's a lot of people employed. It's a small population. A lot of disproportionate number of people mm-hmm. are employed in that particular industry. One of the, I think, Starkist plants literally shut because of that very labor cost.
So
that's jobs
there
being
are
lost.
A lot of unique factors there. Is there an example outside of American Samoa where it's had that kind of an impact.
Well, there's a lot of academic literature that looks at the counties, and I know that there's people who have tried to, it depends on how, what factors you hold constant, the time frames you look at when you look at the economic literature. But there are multiple studies that have shown for again, decades. I know there's newer research. Amy did refer to that, and it's true. There are some organizations out there and researchers who are saying that if you control a little bit differently for this factor or that factor, you're going to find that it doesn't have the impact. But the there's studies that have shown, particularly there's from the University of California, David Newmark, as well as William Washer from the Federal Reserve Board, have been doing research for a number of years, and they do show that there are negative impacts on the employment when you look at situations of surrounding counties to areas of states that haven't increased the minimum wage versus those counties.
Well,
so there is not, I mean, yes, we can throw different reports out and argue that this report doesn't say that and this report does say that, but there is certainly, at the very least, one would have to raise the question that there is academic literature that shows that.
Amy Hanauer, it sounds like Greg Lawson is describing a situation where if we increase certain taxes, for instance, on cigarettes or booze or something like that, when you're in a border area with another state that has a lower tax, there's a lot of competition that way. Have you found that the same thing plays out with something like minimum wage?
You know, I think that, first of all, you know, to cite a study from American Samoa really shows how far Greg is, needing to search for a study that shows a negative employment effect. Because the fact is that in the United States and in developed countries, you just have to search far and wide, and you really have trouble finding a negative employment effect. And that's why 75 prominent economists, including a bunch of Nobel Prize winners, just signed a letter in which they say flat out, research suggests that a minimum wage increase would have a small stimulative effect on the economy as low-wage workers spend their additional earning rising demand and job growth and providing some help on the jobs front. And what is undisputed, of course, and I'm very glad that Greg is agreeing with this, is that for the workers who get the wage increase, they undisputably will be doing better. Yes, if you have a border community and the wages change, there are going to be some complicated things that go on. And that's why raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour makes sense, because then it would be across the country and you wouldn't have to worry about little border effects. But the truth is that more than 21 states have now raised their minimum wage above the federal level. Many communities are really taking things into their own hands and raising the minimum wage much higher than the federal level. So it makes me very excited, because I think it's just a matter of time. This is historically how the federal minimum wage has gone up, is when people around the country sort of sit down and recognize, wait, the lowest income people are not sharing in the growth in our economy, and we're going to take matters into our own hand and raise the minimum wage here. And that's what Ohio voters were smart enough to do in 2006. And I think it's very much what we need if we want an economy that works better for everyone.
Greg Lawson, what if we abolished the minimum wage? Earlier, again, we spoke with Amy Glassmeyer of MIT about how she calculates the living wage and says that even at the minimum wage levels we're at now, we wouldn't get to a living wage as we calculated, or as it is commonly calculated today. What would happen if the minimum wage just went away?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting to point out is that for a lot of individuals with the minimum wage, and there's been some, studies that have looked at marginal tax increases in terms of what you lose when you see hikes to the wages when you're at the lower end of the scale. When you have a panoply of different benefits, we have Medicaid, we do have the SNAP program, food stamp program, and a variety, and there's the TANF, and there's a variety of things. You have to also realize, whereas on one sense the minimum wage can have some benefit, there is the threat for those folks under the way that we have our current benefit structure,
right,
that you hit these points and you start losing those benefits and you see what amounts to a marginal tax increase. Those things aren't necessarily good for folks either. So I do want to bring up the point that there's you have to at least take a look at that and realize that there's consequences to that as well.
I want to get into that.
Wait
a minute. I want to get into that topic. I do. I want to talk about that, and we will. But first, I just wanted to talk about outside of, let's just pretend I mean, what would people do if there were no safety net at all? Regardless of whether the minimum wage now would, an uptick would trigger a downtick in benefits.
Well, I think, though, that the reason I brought that up is because there is still a safety net. I know that
there is.
And I think that that's a key thing to remember is that for folks who don't have, even if you don't have a job, you're looking for the job, you're something there, I know that for a lot of individuals, they think it's not, you know, maybe generous enough or as helpful as it needs to be. But there is a basic thing. We don't tend to have the situation. Yes, there are.
But the same people that want to abolish the minimum wage don't also want to abolish the safety net. I'm not saying all the same people, but all things being equal, the same people that talk about getting rid of the minimum wage also want to get rid of the benefits, the TANF, the SNAP, the...
I don't know that I would... I don't think that that's quite the right characterization. I think that reforming some of those programs is correct, and modifying it and tying it to work requirements and doing things of that nature for multiple different types of programs. Also, Medicaid, by the way, and whether you agree or you disagree, we've now expanded Medicaid in Ohio.
Right.
We do have... people can disagree on the robustness of it, but there is a safety net there. So the concept that if you don't have the minimum wage at all, that people are going to, you know, go into the streets and die, I don't think that's true. We have other programs that are there that provide assistance to people as they're working. And the goal should never be that people work at the minimum wage. The goal should always be that to the extent that that is our position, is always that's a starting place. Mm-hmm. We need people to move up and they need to gain skills. And one of the problems with a lot of people that are lower income is they have challenges with skills and they have a hard time matching what the employers need. If you don't create an ability for people to start to learn some even basic skill, life skills, even like going to getting to work on time, even, which you hear stories where that's actually a challenge. You need these kind of things to move things up so that the minimum wage is literally the starting out the gate. So we need to make clear that we don't want this to be a baseline thing that people stay stuck at forever. And that's the whole concept of reforming the welfare programs, reforming things like this, is we want to be moving people up and off. But we got to get people on first.
Amy, I am going to get to you. We have to take a break, but before we take a break, I want to say well-known and longtime conservative Phyllis Schlafly has said in a recent column that raising the minimum wage might be worth it if it saves money on welfare. The idea is that employers pay less and provide fewer benefits are just foisting the responsibility on the rest of us through federal government supplements like food stamps, school lunches, Medicaid housing vouchers, and earned income tax credit. Amy, when we return, I want to hear from you about if that's the way it should work. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the minimum wage and the living wage. They're not the same thing. With Amy Hanauer, she's Executive Director of Policy Matters Ohio, and Greg Lawson from the Buckeye Institute. Why don't we turn to this Facebook message from Dan, Amy, and then we can maybe go back to what I said about Phyllis Schlafly, who apparently believes in part with this. Dan writes, in this era of an employer's job market, it makes no sense for businesses to pay any more than they can get away with. Why should society let them externalize their labor costs, forcing people onto public assistance in order to subsidize their low wages and no benefits jobs?
Right. Okay. So, again, a lot for me to try to take on, but I love, love, love the fact that Greg Lawson just said we shouldn't raise the minimum wage because we're worried that it might reduce the cost to public sector programs and reduce people's recipiency of public.
You mean it might trigger their get them off, they won't qualify
anymore.
Yeah,
I'm glad that Greg is so concerned about that. The truth is that, you know, what we really want is a society where work rewards workers and where people are able to make a living off of what they earn in the workplace. And as your guest earlier this morning, she has this great website with a living wage calculator that shows that in order for people to, people who are parents or people who have other expenses really can't live even on the 10-10 an hour minimum wage if they are parents. So the fact is, we need a higher wage. We need a higher minimum wage. It will, in fact, reduce the cost of public programs. It will reduce the cost of the earned income tax credit. It will reduce the cost of food assistance and other sorts of assistance that we provide. So it's just the best way that we have to make sure that work pays, to reduce poverty and to reduce inequality, and the preponderance of economic evidence really shows that now. And, you know, it's also just how we have an economy that's really broadly shared. And so for a long time, over the sort of second half of the 20th century, we had a reasonable minimum wage, and we expanded some parts of the safety net, and we provided education. And those things together contributed to a society that kind of grew together, where the wealthy were certainly gaining, but the middle income were gaining and the lowest income were gaining too. And that's, I think, the kind of society that we ought to all want, is one in which when we grow together. In the last generation, we've let the minimum wage, the value of the minimum wage, erode. We've chipped away at those public programs, and we've stopped contributing, you know, sort of more and more to education, and we've stopped increasing our investment in education. And as a result, we have a society that's growing apart, where the very, 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 very wealthiest are continuing to grow. But even the upper middle class, certainly the middle class, working class families and poor families are being left behind in our economy. So the minimum wage is one very small way that we can make a dent in that.
Greg, let's go back to the Facebook message from Dan. He asks, why should society let these employers, and one of the biggest ones is Walmart, owned by some of the richest people in the world, why should we let them externalize labor costs, forcing people onto public assistance in order to subsidize their low wages and no benefit jobs?
Well, there's a superficial way of looking at that, to the extent that, oh, that may seems to make the most sense when you first hear it. But the problem is everybody benefits, or many people benefit from the lower cost of the goods that we have at Walmart. I mean, Walmart has done a lot of things. It's why it's always a very busy store. It's why there's so many of them. And there's a reason for that. They have goods that they sell cheaper that stretches the resources that people have further. Again, we can debate about the academic literature, but it's my position and it's our position that we think there will be adverse impacts on employment when you raise these cost employers, because they're going to find ways to economize. They've already done it, and already have started doing that. And if you do those kind of things, you're going to have people who don't have jobs at all. So all this talk of making work pay, we agree. I mean, all the reforms that the Buckeye Institute always promotes is about making sure that work pays and that people can have the dignity of work. The fear that we have is that we believe the evidence does show that there will be these impacts and that people won't even have jobs. So to the extent that we're going to have, you know, the right. welfare program spending less, well, again, do they spend less on a handful on the number of people that have the increase versus how many more people now don't get the jobs and don't get moving up? And you look at unemployment rates. Look at certain subsections of demographics where there's unemployment that is far higher than the top line numbers that you see. Well, double digits, especially for younger people and for African Americans, especially young African Americans. You still have close to, I think, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, around 40% unemployment. That is a massive number for young African Americans. How are we going to try to get jobs there? And taking this and making it where employers are going to say, we're going to hire people with higher skills, okay, because we have to pay more.
One of the benefits I read about increasing the minimum wage is it does force employers to work harder and smarter and do more with less. That's not necessarily, it's been some of the big, I've read that historically some of a lot of innovation comes from higher wages.
Well, some of that innovation also will be, I'll tell you, McDonald's, over the next years, you hike this thing to maybe not the 10-10, but you do some of the talk of $14 or $15 that we've seen some of the unions promoting in certain states. You're going to see kiosks. You're going to see iPad-based or kiosks where people order food from computers. I mean, you can already order food, pizza, from your iPhone. You take the guy still answers the phone and does it. But you're going to get to the point where even at the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and Wendy's, et cetera, you're going to eventually technologize people out of jobs. I mean, that's a trend that's likely to happen irrespective of what we're talking about today. That's just the reality. But you're going to expedite that process and make it much harder for people, because you're going to have maybe only two-thirds of the people staffing a restaurant.
Amy Hanauer?
You know, I mean, I think that one of the really interesting things about this conversation is that, you know, Greg and his organization have really promoted reducing taxes for corporations in Ohio, reducing taxes for the very wealthiest in Ohio, and reducing the funds available to the public sector. And here we have a policy reform that would cost the public sector absolutely nothing, in fact, would save the public sector money, and would raise wages at the bottom, and they're still against it. And so the only thing that you could conclude from somebody who wants to cut the safety net, get rid of, you know, not have an earned income tax credit, cut public programs, cut public jobs, and cut the wages of minimum wage workers, the only thing that you can conclude is that this is an organization that wants to see corporate profits higher for the very wealthiest and wants to see our economy grow more unequal and wants to see the bottom earning less. The fact is that we know how to have a broadly shared prosperity, and we know how to have an economy that works for everyone. And the minimum wage is part of that. It's far from the only thing that we need to have an economy that works really well. There's a huge number of investments that we need to be making instead of cutting local government, cutting teachers, and cutting public programs. We should be making sure that the public sector workers who deliver things that we all need are able to keep those jobs. And we should be, frankly, we should be retrofitting and blowing insulation into every building in Ohio. There are a whole bunch of investments that we could make that would actually make our economy much more efficient going forward. But, you know, the minimum wage is certainly just a nice, small, modest starting point.
John, in Marysville, you're on the air with Amy Henauer of Policy Matters Ohio and Greg Lawson of the Buckeye Institute. Welcome to the show, John.
Well, thank you. And Greg, I guess you're on record then. Your organization is on record of supporting Medicaid expansion?
As supporting Medicaid? No, we did not support the Medicaid expansion. We had alternative ideas that we had discussed for health care coverage, but not the expansion as it was done for a variety of reasons.
Okay, John, now do you want to ask your question? Do I have a comment? Is that it?
I just had a question. In Washington State, they raised the minimum wage above the federal minimum wage. And the problem they had with the border with Idaho was people from Idaho were going to Washington to get the higher minimum wage, and they were getting harder workers, people on time, working hard. So it had the net effect of taking workers away from a low minimum wage state. You know, if you pay people to work, they're going to work.
Okay. Thank you, John.
I mean, I think that the caller raises a great point. You know, I think that when you raise wages, it actually makes people able to be better workers. You know, Greg mentioned earlier that, you know, all minimum wage or lots of minimum wage workers are low skill. He didn't say also. I apologize for that. But the fact is that when people are paid a little more, they can have a more reliable form of transportation. They can have more reliable childcare. They may be able to give up a second or third job and get a little more sleep at night. So they're actually the very same person is able to be a better employee when they're paid a little bit more, which is something I certainly know as an employer, that when you treat people decently, they're able to give more. So I think it's a great way to get a higher productive, more happier and better performing workforce.
Email from Becky writes, one of the things that I constantly hear people say about minimum wage jobs is that these jobs aren't meant to be someone's main source of income, that they're not meant to support a family. First, it's not a secret that the U.S. has been bleeding decent blue-collar jobs for low-skilled workers in industries like manufacturing for many years. Second, since the recent recession, a great portion of the new job creation has been in minimum wage jobs like fast food and retail. My question is it fair to count these jobs as part of the post-recession job creation figures and then turn around and say that they're not meant to support a family? Is there really any job that someone can do full-time all year that shouldn't provide a decent income? And I think that's a really interesting way to couch the question is these jobs are counted. They are certainly counted. Do you think it's fair, Greg Lawson, that they be counted as part of the post-recession job creation figures when they can't really support a family?
I think it's fair that they are counted in the overall numbers, but I also think that it is also something we have to realize that we're undergoing a systematic economic change. The information revolution, all things we have going on right now, is one of the biggest changes we've seen since we industrialized. This is which changed us from a farming country to an industrial country. We're going through a shift of, quite frankly, equal magnitude. We don't really know. Nobody can tell you. No government official and no private business can tell you what the end state of the economy is going to be. It is probably going to be a very high-skilled thing. those people with a lot of knowledge, a lot of education, capacity, things like that are going to be able to still do very well, and they still do very well and are highly compensated. Those individuals that used to be able to do the blue collar, the manufacturing jobs, which was obviously a cornerstone of Ohio's economy for many, many years, that's going to be a much more challenging thing. What we have to do is we cannot allow those individuals to just to get dropped off. And your height, we have a disagreement. Amy and I have a fundamental disagreement. I think the academic literature raises serious problems with this concept that it's going to be able to make all of these sunshine stories come true relative to people are going to be happier, we're going to have more effective workers, maybe for those that have the jobs. But I keep coming back to the point, I think there will be over time a negative, especially depending on how high we go with this. And there's really no, I mean, with the living wage, there's not really a limit to where we're going to cap that or where we're going to talk about it. So we talk about the minimum wage today, but we're going to be talking about the same thing every 5 years. Mm-hmm. There's no limit. There is a limit to how that's going to impact jobs in terms of the fact that the higher it goes, the more it's going to be. The higher it goes, the more detrimental that'll be to job creation. And I think that's a bad situation. We talk about all the people who you know, can't live and things like that. I would submit it's very hard to live when you don't have any income, and you are going to see government programs expanding far more as people don't have jobs at all. So I think that we have to realize that we're going to have to do a lot more than talk about the minimum wage to get people the skill sets. Now we got education. We talk about how do we do education. Those are broader
arguments.
That's
what we were talking about earlier, is who's going to pay for it, because there's no discretionary income after, you know, you take care of a living wage. But Amy Henauer, I just want to make sure you're getting in there. You're out of sight, out of mind a little bit, and I apologize.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that it's interesting because Greg's organization, of course, supports cutting school budgets and cutting higher education budgets. So it's interesting that he says he thinks education is the answer, because I don't know how people are going to get more educated if we're cutting education budgets. But more to the point, you know, the fact is that Greg acts as if the economy is just something that happens to us. The fact is we choose the kind of economy we want to have, and we chose in the second half of the 20th century to have an economy in which we were investing in people, investing in places, investing in communities, investing in education, and as a result, we created the world's first middle class. We did that in America. We created the world's first middle class. We pulled a lot of people out of poverty, and of course they did so to themselves through their own work, but we created a system where it was possible to work hard, to get ahead, to earn more than your parents had earned, to have a better job than your parents had had, and we created the world's first middle class. And then the rest of Western Europe said, hey, this is a great idea, and hopped on board and did much the same thing. And now we have been retreating from that while, you know, I think in many ways a country like Germany continues to invest in its education, continues to say that we're going to pay people reasonably, and continues to say that workers have a right to representation on a job. And as a result, they are beginning to outpace us in economic well-being. They have much lower rates of poverty, and they have workers who are doing a lot better. So Greg acts like the economy just happens to us. I happen to think we are, you know, there's a lot that we can do to create the kind of economy that we want to have in this country. We've done it before. And, you know, I look and I can tell you the kind of economy that I want to have is one where a home health care worker that is taking care of my grandmother is able to feed her kids and pay for her essential needs. And technology has nothing to do with her job. I mean, you know, she uses technology and that's fine. But the fact is many of the jobs that are paid a sub-minimum wage or paid a minimum wage, you know, aren't going to be taken away by technology. We need these people. In fact, as we have an aging population, we're going to need home health workers and other kinds of personal assistance even more. These jobs are not subject to international competition, and they are not particularly subject to technological change. And it's just a question of whether we think that woman who gets up in the morning and goes to someone's house and turns her over and bathes her and takes care of her, whether we think that woman deserves an adequate wage or not. And I vote yes, she does.
I want to give you each 30 seconds more. Greg, I'm counting right now. Go.
No, I it's a beautiful vision, but I think that we also have to understand the historical context. When the middle class really got developed, it was after World War II. And we forget that Europe and Asia and everybody was utterly devastated, flat on their back after the worst cataclysm in human history. America had a lot of good things that went for it, but we shouldn't forget that the competition was a lot different back then them because they were utterly in ruins. And the world is different. China's different. Japan's different. East Asia's different. We have a much more competitive economy, and that's why we have to be very careful about these kind of things that put us at a competitive disadvantage.
Amy Hanauer?
You know, I will tell you, it doesn't put us at a competitive disadvantage to invest in our workforce, to invest in our people, and to have a decent wage. And Germany has learned that and knows it, and a lot of Western Europe knows it too. The fact is, we are more productive than we've ever been before. We are wealthier than we've ever been before. And if we could afford to share our prosperity over the second half of the 20th century, we can afford to share it now. You know, and it's just, we want an economy that works for everyone.
I got to let you go, Amy Hanauer of Policy Matters Ohio. Thanks again. It's always a joy.
Thank you.
Greg Lawson, analyst for Buckeye Institute. Greg as well. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And we'll continue this conversation. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.